Hey, Leading Learning listener, if improving as a learning business professional is one of your goals for 2026, make sure to go to leadinglearning.com/summit.
The Learning Business Summit is the only event laser-focused on professionals who lead and work in market-facing businesses that serve adult learners. Across 3 days online, you'll connect with peers and experts to strengthen both your knowledge and your network.
Featuring hands-on practitioners and subject matter experts, the live education sessions are designed for participation, reflection, and, most importantly, action to boost the reach, revenue, and impact of your learning business.
And because leveraging technology is essential for any learning business, the summit also includes demos of LearnTech platforms.
It all happens online January 27th, 28th, and 29th. Go to leadinglearning.com/summit to get all the details and join us for the Learning Business Summit.
Now, on with the episode.
If you're a leader or an aspiring leader in the business of lifelong learning, you're in the right place. I'm Salisa Steele.
And I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 193 of the Leading Learning Podcast, where we talk with Ray Schroeder, Associate Vice Chancellor for Online Learning and Founding Director of the Center for Online Learning Research and Service at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also the Founding Director of the National Council for Online Education at the University Professional and Continuing Education Association. So, Salisa, what do you and Ray talk about?
Well, we cover a lot of ground because Ray has a real depth of experience. He started teaching in 1971, and then he got into online learning in 1997. So he's got decades worth of observations and experience and insight to share. We talk about workforce development issues and the skills gap, as those are issues that Ray is really passionate about. He sees them as job one and imperative for learning businesses. The role of continuing ed and online learning and learning businesses is significant as we move into what Ray calls the age of the 60-year learner, borrowing a phrase from Hunt Lambert of Harvard. But it's also a concept that you and I have talked and written about, Jeff. It started out for us as the other 50 years, and that's actually grown as life expectancy keeps inching up. And if folks at home want to play buzzword bingo, I'd say get your cards ready, because I think Ray and I hit on all the biggies: AI, virtual reality, augmented reality, badges, blockchain, curation.
Well, it's clear just from the titles that he's carrying and the things that he's founded that he truly does have a lot of experience, a lot of depth, and it sounds like you did cover a lot of ground. So let's definitely get rolling with this interview with Ray Schroeder.
Hello, and welcome to the Leading Learning Podcast. I'm Salisa Steele, and today I'm joined by Ray Schroeder. Ray is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Online Learning and Founding Director of the Center for Online Learning Research and Service at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also the Founding Director at the National Council for Online Education at the University Professional and Continuing Education Association. Ray is widely recognized as a leading expert in online education, and he brings both deep knowledge of and a passion for advancing the field of online education. He's been engaged in online learning since 1997, and he's built a very successful program with more than 20 online degree and certificate programs at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a consultant, a speaker, and an author. Ray, welcome to the Leading Learning Podcast.
Thank you so much, Salisa. It's great to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
As do I. And so, you know, I had to condense a long lifetime of work and all that you've done into just a few sentences. So I want to give you a chance here at the beginning to highlight anything else that you would like for listeners to know about yourself and your work as we then begin our conversation.
Okay, well, only briefly that this has for me been an exciting career. You know, I started teaching at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in 1971. So, you know, it's 48 years, and I've seen so many changes in higher education, in learning, in technology. And so it's been very rewarding for me to be part of that process over those decades.
Well, that's great. And I think all that perspective and experience will be wonderful to hear as you answer some of these questions that I've pulled together for you. And I know one place I wanted to start is that in a recent article called Five Key Trends for Professional and Continuing Education Leaders in the Next 5 Years, and we can link to that article in the show notes. In that article, you really assert that continuing education, professional development, and online programs have become of central importance to traditional universities. You know, they started more at the periphery, but now they really are key. So would you just give us the broad strokes of the changes that have caused that move from the periphery to the center?
Sure. You know, in the earlier days, I'll say 80s, 90s, continuing ed and online ed, as it developed then later in the late 1990s, was really on the outside. It was not the main business of higher education at colleges and universities. It was nice to do little community things and show that you were engaged, you know, and there were some excellent programs. I'm not to say that there were not, but broadly in central administration, the attention was not there. The attention was to the traditional high school graduate coming to a college or university. And over the last 25 years, that has changed dramatically. You know, what we used to call the traditional college student is no longer. That's a smaller minority of the students in higher education. The average age is 25 or older. The students, many of them are already in a career and looking to advance in their careers. So the student population has changed. At the same time, there have been other changes, and I kind of look at this as, if you can imagine, a virtual Venn diagram with three circles. And continuing education and professional ed is right at the center, at the overlap. So the first circle would be student demand. You know, students today are demanding results from their investment in higher ed, and they're paying far more than ever. And we could talk about that, but it's a long story. The bottom line is higher ed costs much more than it used to, and students are paying throughout their careers, with a total debt up in the trillion, $1.5 trillion in the United States. So students want to see results in terms of employment, in terms of careers, in terms of salary. So that's one influence, and that's changed in the last 20 years. Employers now are demanding more. They say that the graduates of today that they're seeing are falling short in communication skills, computational skills, leadership, creative thinking, critical thinking. They're really looking for us to fill in those gaps so that the new hires can hit the road running. They can start right away. And then finally, recently came the announcement that now 8 straight years we have dropped in enrollment at colleges and universities across the country. And in fact, there still has been growth, but the growth has been in online. The growth has been among what we used to call those non-traditional students, that is those job-holding people who are seeking to advance their careers. So universities are seeking now to hit those new enrollment areas, no longer just the high school, but increasingly the lifelong learner, or Hunt Lambert of Harvard calls them the 60-year learner. Well, those three changes, that is student demand, employer demand, and university enrollment drops, all combine to make universities' administrators see that most of their learners are ones that they have not been serving well. And so they're pulling in the online units, the continuing unit, the professional ed units to the mainstream and putting them right under the provost so that they can put an emphasis on that growth area. I might add that the lifelong learner, that 60-year learner, is a phenomenon that really is taking hold. with tech advances in our economy, we're seeing much more rapid job expirations, that is, jobs going out of date, on the order of, for many employees, every 5 years. So these employees need to upskill, they need to update continuously if they're going to be continuously employed. So we're approaching this 100-year life expectancy in this country. So we're going to be able to expect that people are going to work into their 70s and 80s. So once again, there's an expansion over time of the need for this continuing professional online service to employees.
Well, thank you for explaining sort of those three circles and what's been driving this move to put continuing education, professional development, online learning really at the center of universities. And I think you've begun to get into this because employer demand was one of those circles that you just mentioned. But I would love to get your take on workforce development issues and the role of learning businesses. So those continuing ed programs at academic institutions, associations, training companies, edupreneurs, what should those types of learning businesses be doing in addressing those workforce development issues?
Yeah, workforce development is job one for all of those categories you mentioned. You know, in fact, this is really, I commonly call it the moral act of the 21st century. You know, I'm in Illinois, and we happily claim Abraham Lincoln as one of ours. But back in his administration in 1864, I believe, he signed the first moral act, which set up land-grant institutions. And the concept even way back then was to have institutions provide education for agriculture, engineering, mechanical, and other useful, as they call them, useful professions. And that's where we are now. But we're doing it electronically. We're doing it digitally. We're doing it in a concerted way. And that's really what taxpayers are looking for, prospective students and their families, and employers are demanding this. This is, how do we integrate this rapidly changing economy and the infusion of artificial intelligence, quantum computing, of emerging technologies into our economy? How do we keep our skilled workers prepared for that, constantly evolving with the advancements? If we fail, there are hundreds of alternatives out there. And this is where the savvy entrepreneur, edu-entrepreneur, if you will, or edupreneur, as you said, can really take a lead. Ryan Craig authored a book called A New You, Faster and Cheaper Alternatives to College. And he asserts there are better alternatives coming than the traditional general education, four-year plotting program for students. And the difficulty there is that our students are anxious to begin to fill these jobs, and the needs for these jobs are different. You know, in fact, I even came across a new website called Alternatives to College, and they have 200 examples of ways to get a good job without a college education. Totally legitimate. I mean, I think that's very important. In fact, I recently posted a link that of 16 degree certificates, so short of the baccalaureate, that start at $70,000 to $100,000 a year. And the average college graduate receives just short of $50,000 a year. So when you're looking at the payday, at the outcome, at the end of the learning experience, you know, there are alternatives that are very effective. And then there's a growing number of companies that no longer require the baccalaureate. Apple, Google, IBM, Bank of America. There are many, many more. They're beginning to recognize that we're in a more specialized employment environment in which we're expecting upgrades and upskilling every 3 to 5 years. So they're willing to waive the baccalaureate if they can get people with the personal values and attributes that fit their corporation. So if higher education, particularly the universities, want to continue to hold the leading role they've enjoyed in preparing the workforce, they've got to change. They've got to become agile and responsive to the needs of the employers.
Well, great. Well, thanks for kind of pulling together that picture of what's coming and bringing to bear on the choices about learning that individual learners face, and then, of course, organizations providing that learning are facing.
If your learning business is looking for a partner to help you execute on the choices you're making about how to best serve your learners, we encourage you to check out our sponsor. CompPartners helps learning businesses conceive, develop, and fulfill their online education strategy. Their solutions begin with Elevate LMS, an award-winning learning platform that provides a central knowledge community and drives learner engagement. To extend the value of Elevate, CompPartners provides a wide range of online education services, including curriculum design, instructional design, fully managed webinars, webcast, live stream programs, and virtual conferences. Find out more at leadinglearning.com/compartners. And now, back to the interview as Salisa asks Ray about the role of AI in learning and education.
And so if we pick up a bit and look at some of the other large trends that are happening in the space, I'd like to ask you about artificial intelligence, because I know you moderated a panel recently called "Is Artificial Intelligence the Future of Education?" And you did that at the IMS Global Leadership Institute. And so give us the answer, you know, is AI the future of education?
Well, the short answer is yes. Certainly there's a huge role for AI in our future. But what a great panel that was. We had top leaders from IBM, Google, Georgia Tech, McGraw-Hill, and Strategic Education. That was a great discussion of where we are today, where we're going to be in 3 to 5 years, and the challenges that we're going to have to overcome as we move forward. AI is already playing a role. I mean, you know, artificial intelligence is such a broad field. We talk about deep learning and machine learning, and, you know, there are so many parts, visual recognition and, you know, the interfaces between human and computers interacting together. So much of that is driven by AI that it's behind the scenes and we don't really know it. However, AI is providing a prominent role on working with big data. And there's been a big emphasis on really using data-driven, you know, decision-making in higher education. So what AI does for us, it allows us to handle larger data sets to make accurate predictions based on trends in those data sets and to learn from its prior predictions and what turns out in reality. So selecting students, placing students, informing advisors of strengths and weaknesses and the like, all of those are driven by AI. More directly, though, in the teaching and learning process, AI is the engine for adaptive learning. When we talk about adaptive learning, that's an instance where the computer or the program, the algorithm in artificial intelligence, can over time determine what the students' learning levels are, where there are deficits, where they're more advanced, and it can customize a path of learning rather than what we've been doing for so many years. And for me, it's been almost half a century, where you kind of aim at the middle of the class and you disappoint those advanced learners and you confuse the learners that aren't there yet. So what AI can do is to make sure each student gets a personalized learning experience. And then there's Ashok Goel. You know, I'm a huge fan. He's a professor at Georgia Tech. I've had the good fortune to share lunch with him a couple of times. He's the fellow who developed what he called Jill Watson. He was teaching and continues to teach artificial intelligence for Georgia Tech, teaching a class of 400 students. He had 7 TAs, one of them, Jill, who kind of lag behind the first year I did this. That was 4 years ago, but got better. And by the end of the semester, she was nominated for TA of the Year. But of course, as the name implies, that she was a Watson computer program, an AI program that answered the questions of the students in the class. This was part of their online master's of computer science, but it's at scale. And so the importance of having a smart, in quotes, a smart program as a teaching assistant is enormous. Probably the most important part is it saves the faculty members time, because so much of the time is eaten up by repeating what you've said once and again. And when's the midterm? How long's the paper? Will you accept this? Is that okay? And being able to answer those, but also to answer content questions. So by developing machine learning into deep learning, and this program, this algorithm did that, it was able to now begin to answer questions about content and would respond when it had the program ascertained a 97% certainty that it had the right answer. If it didn't, it would refer to the professor, and then it would learn from the answer. And so you have that cycle. Well, Ashok is developing that so that it can be affordable on different platforms, not just Watson, so that commercial entities, middle schools, even high schools, colleges can afford to have this kind of assistant, which really makes teaching much more efficient. So the faculty member can devote their time to those students who are truly struggling and not looking for kind of the simple answers. I would say AI chat boxes, similar to Jill, but chat boxes for advising and tutoring, certainly scheduling. This can all be done better. Having been an advisor for a couple of decades, oh my, you know, what a nightmare that was on paper back in the 70s, you know, all the requirements and prereqs and schedules. Well, now all that's done by AI, and I think done much better. Academic advising, so looking ahead at schedules and making sure that everything fits moving forward. And then there's the whole area of assistance, intelligent assistance, both for faculty members and for students. So for faculty members, can gather data from the web and elsewhere and help you prepare material. But what we will see, I'm sure, within the next year or two, if not already, are student assistants to whom, let's say like an Alexa or a Google Home, you can say, hey, Google, I have a paper due in 30 minutes. It has to be a 10-page paper with 8 annotated resources in the bibliography. And once again, I need that in 15 minutes so that you can print out a copy and I'll carry it to class. So please do that. And well, there are programs already that do that kind of thing. So then the question arises for the faculty member, how do you make assignments? And is that appropriate? I mean, maybe it's like, you know, I date myself, but calculators are coming in the 60s, you know, the Texas Instruments and whatnot. And they were banned at first, but now we begin to recognize that calculators are going to be there. So maybe your personal assistant is going to be there. And maybe writing papers will not be the standard in higher education. So we need to think about that. We need to think about what expectations we have as technology continues to evolve. So I think we have some interesting times coming up in the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, no, I think that last point is especially interesting around this idea of how do we measure or assess that learning is taking place in an AI informed and driven world, and maybe it does radically change how we assess learners.
As Ray pointed out, AI is a major factor in data-driven decisions. If you're looking for help with data analytics, we suggest you check out our sponsor. Authentic Learning Labs is an e-learning company that offers products and services to help improve your current investments in education. One key product is Authentic Analytics, a dedicated suite of visualization reports to help analyze and predict the performance of education programs. Organizations use Authentic Analytics to easily scan through volumes of data and intuitive visuals, chart performance trends, and quickly spot opportunities, issues, and potential future needs. Find out more at leadinglearning.com/authentic. And now, back to the interview as Lisa asks Ray about XR.
So to follow up on AI, let's get another buzzword in, extended reality. I would love to get your thoughts on the future of virtual and augmented reality for learning.
I think that there are many applications. And so we've looked at the low-hanging fruit, although that's not necessarily, in this case, the easiest, but if you will, the most important. And I serve on the Technology Advisory Committee for the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and they're using AI where students can use virtual reality and go through an operation. Let's say you're a surgery resident. You can go through that operation once, twice, and then scrub and go in to the operating room. And I like that idea of being able to have just-in-time experience in those kinds of things, but also broadly in learning. So virtual and augmented reality, mixed reality sometimes called, where we put the two together, or augmented, really work together very well. I recently attended the 4th annual U.S.-China Smart Education Conference, where developers of both those countries began sharing ideas in the fields of VR, AR, AI. And it's fascinating to see what's going on and also some of the cultural differences. Perhaps we'll get a chance to talk about that later. But VR and mixed reality has demonstrated success in the medical field. And Carnegie Mellon particularly has been a leader in this field to assist with anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, certainly diagnoses, surgery, many other areas. Mixed reality has a significant potential in the arts, in history, in sociology, in design, architecture, so many areas where with mixed reality we can create environments or recreate past environments to help build understanding for our students. And in doing so, they have a deeper cultural understanding as well as the architectural, if you will, or art changes over the years. And then distance students, of course, that's an area I'm most interested in. One of our challenges has always been, golly, you know, how do you have that laboratory experience? And what about wet labs? Well, you know, what's happening now is that fewer and fewer industries truly have hands-on beakers and test tubes. More often, they're using a computer to titrate those chemicals together. And so that certainly can be replicated, emulated, simulated through augmented and virtual reality. And that allows for virtual labs. And that opens up a whole world for students who are seeking a degree, a certificate, or learning in fields like nursing and so many other, chemistry and biology, but in so many fields where otherwise they couldn't do it easily at a distance, and yet they were not in a personal position where they could leave their family and, you know, and live in the dorm for 2 years. So this is a really big breakthrough, virtual labs, and I see a tremendous advantage for us all as we move forward.
Well, since you raised it, as you were talking about, you know, mixed reality and these the potential that you're seeing there, you raised the cultural differences. So I want to give you a chance because that did pique my curiosity. What do you see as some of the key cultural differences around the use of mixed reality for learning?
Yeah, so as we use mixed reality, it is what do we use as an example? And how does that resonate with the background of our students, mm-hmm. with the aspirations of our students, of what environment they're going to become employed in. And there are different environments in different corporations. Certainly there are less formal, more formal. And in those meetings with the representatives from China, I saw a significant difference in the way in which they approached their development of programs. And that's something that there's been some writing about. Certainly Amy Webb has a book out just a couple of months ago, The Big Nine, How Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Can Warp Humanity. Well, you know, she had, I think it was six American and three Chinese companies and their different approaches. So I think that there is a big difference culturally. And it's not just China. I mean, even within the U.S., it's certainly there are gender differences. And one of my good colleagues, Yakut Gaziz, who from Georgia Tech, you know, points out that there are gender differences. And when we look at AI and create algorithms, the scenarios presented by male programmers and workers are different than those presented by women.
Excellent. Yeah, so thank you for highlighting that issue around both cultural and gender and just sort of other differences and how those can then be reflected through AI and mixed reality, and that's something we need to grapple with. So I'm not going to give up a chance to get in a few more buzzwords, and so I want to ask about badges and blockchain. And in particular, what do you see as the possibilities for badging and blockchain? Do you think they're going to supplement or replace kind of our current traditional credentials?
I believe they're going to absolutely replace, certainly blockchain. Badging, I think, is very important, and it's really kind of a building block, if you will, for blockchain itself. So badges first provide more information to employers, to graduate schools, to others, in detailing the experience that students document through taking a course or an internship or a part-time employment experience. But the big revolutionary difference comes with blockchain, which is a secure ledger system. Right now, if you have a parking ticket from a couple of years ago at a college you attended, you may well not be able to get your transcript sent to an employer. It's because the university dominates. It holds tightly your credentials. But those are credentials you paid for as a student that you should own, that you should control. And so blockchain will enable you to take your credentials and control them and add to the classes you took at college, add an internship, add these various other experiences, even self-taught experiences with documentation. And so mostly what blockchain does, it takes, in essence, a badge. I mean, it wouldn't have to be formally badged, but it has that level of content information. Maybe in the case of a class, it could be your final project, it could be the books you used, and some other samples of your work. And all of that you control on the blockchain. So badging gives you verifiable skills, like those soft skills we talked about before. But universities are beginning to recognize the need to document those skills through badges. So, you know, I have an article that I think will be out as this is released, and it's on the topic of the advent of blockchain in higher ed. It's an inside higher ed. In brief, blockchain is going to provide a secure ledger for student learning, including those badged experiences and transcripts merged together. The key aspect of the advent of blockchain in higher ed is it'll put the transcript into the control of the student rather than the university. And it will be secure, and it will outlive the university. We've seen a lot of colleges close in the last couple of years. So that blockchain will continue to carry those credentials.
Well, great. This has been wonderful to talk about some of these trends that are really taking hold, like AI, like mixed reality, like blockchain. But now I just want to kind of open it up and let you take us wherever you would like to go. So when you think big picture about what's out there on the horizon for learning in the coming, let's say, 5 years or so, you know, what most excites you?
Well, I'm fascinated with quantum computing. It is within 5 years, and it's really in that 3 to 5 year horizon. So quantum computing is, you might expect, is much faster. And I won't go into the details of qubits, but they are essentially like bits, binary bits, except they have some neat features. And they're at the base of quantum computing. What currently would take a supercomputer 30 years to complete will be finished in a day on a quantum computer. It's 10,000 times faster than the fastest computers we have today. And then there's this phenomenal aspect where qubits can be entangled. You can take qubits and entangle them such that if you do something to one, it automatically happens at the other. And then a recent experiment was done by sending some qubits into space that have been entangled. They changed them and using atomic clocks, changed them here on Earth and also out on a satellite. And they found that it changed faster than they could calculate. They knew it was faster than 10,000 times faster than the speed of light. Faster than, isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated by quantum mechanics, but quantum computing in particular, and it's secure. So in that case, we don't even know. No one today knows how that happens. How does that happen? And so it's secure because you can, you know, let's say your bank account, you can withdraw something here and it changes there, but there's no way to intercept it. So that's kind of an interesting aspect. But what that also means is that we're going to be able to more completely serve the individual student and reach that holy grail of personalized learning as we use it to drive adaptive learning.
Well, it's fascinating. I'm very intrigued by those qubits as well. And, you know, all along as we've been talking, right, you've shared different book titles and different articles, and you put out a lot of content on a daily basis on an array of social media sites and blog sites. And I know you have thousands of followers and readers. And so, you know, a lot of what you're doing there is sharing, and you're curating that. And so I would love to get your view on curation in the context of learning. What role does curation play?
Yeah, I think that's very important. You know, going back to, I don't know, it was the late 80s or thereabouts, early 90s maybe, I was teaching a graduate seminar in emerging technologies in the electronic media. And one of the challenges I had was students were not coming up, you know, they had to critique articles, but they didn't come up with very good articles or very current articles. So I began using a listserv, and back then there was Pyra Labs that was bought out by Google to create Blogger. And so I started with Pyra's Blogger and migrated to Google and began putting things on. And then as the students graduated, someone became faculty members at other universities, but they did not unsubscribe. They continued to follow the blog, and I began to realize that this is something broadly that was useful. And since I was doing it every day, I may as well continue. So now I've expanded that a bit. I've got 5 blogs. There's no advertising, no spam, nothing. You know, it's just out there. Look at it. You can subscribe to it through Feedburner, which is a Google service, but there are no ads on that either. So it's freely available, but every day, every evening, usually, I go through 150 articles. I have a little counter, and I try to go through at least 150 news releases, publications, articles, and choose 3, for example, in higher ed, technology or online and continuing ed is one of the blogs. So I choose what I think are 3 that are important to me as an associate vice chancellor in this area. And I do the same for K-12 and some other areas. So all of those are out there. I think they're very important. We all don't have the luxury of drinking from that fire hose. So, so curating this, because it comes out at such a rapid rate, is, I think, a useful function. And my goal is not that people cite me, that they just grab one of those articles every week or two and send it on to their boss and say, hey, look what I found, and use it to move forward. So it's not something that I need, other than putting it up there for consideration, that I need a role in.
Well, I think it's a great service, so thank you for doing that. And we'll begin to wrap up our conversation here. And so as the next to last question, I want to ask you one that we ask of all guests, and it focuses on your personal learning specifically. What is one of the most powerful learning experiences you've been involved in as an adult since finishing up your formal education?
And of course, there have been so many. You know, UPSEA, UPCEA, does many, and gosh, there was the a program on emerging leaders and online learning. But I think more recently, it's been the U.S.-China Smart Education Conference that I mentioned previously. It was so remarkable because of the deep discussions among those people who actually were authoring the algorithms in China as well as here, with corporations from both sides talking to one another as we look at the future of AI in higher ed. So those important discussions, I think, really were meaningful to me.
Well, that's great. So final question, just if listeners want to know more about you and your work or connect with you, where would you have them go?
I have a small website. It's rayschroeder.com. And at that site, I have links to those blogs and to Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, where I put out these feeds of curated reading lists. And there's also, you can click to contact, and I check my email every 20 minutes. So, and of course, if you text me, I'll do the same. So it's always great to make new connections.
Well, great. We'll make sure to get that website into the show notes. Ray, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate all that you've shared.
Thank you.
That concludes the interview with Ray Schroeder. To get show notes, go to leadinglearning.com/episode193.
When you check out the show notes, you're going to see various options for subscribing to the podcast. And if you're getting value out of what you hear, Jeff and I would be truly grateful if you would subscribe, as it helps us to get some data on the impact of what we're doing with the podcast.
Yes, please do hit that subscribe button. And we'd also be grateful if you take just a minute to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. All you have to do is go to leadinglearning.com/Apple. Salise and I personally appreciate your rating and review, but more importantly, reviews and ratings play a big role in helping the podcast show up when people are searching for content on leading a learning business.
And we would be grateful if you check out our sponsors for this quarter. Find out more about Authentic Learning Labs at leadinglearning.com/authentic. And find out what Calm Partners has to offer at leadinglearning.com/calmpartners.
Finally, consider telling others about the podcast. You can send out a tweet by going to leadinglearning.com/share. And you can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/leadinglifelonglearning. And of course, you can share us with others there. However you do it, please spread the word about Leading Learning.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.